This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
Oh, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. A tip of a hat this morning to Republican senators, Arlen Specter and Chuck Grassley, two men who had the courage of their convictions to stand up on the Senate Judiciary Committee just a few hours ago and vote for contempt of Congress resolutions against Karl Rove and Josh Bolten for refusing to comply with subpoenas from that committee for information about the U.S. attorney scandal. By the way, the third hour of our program, we're going to get into that in some considerable detail. Scott Horton is here with Harper's Magazine, who has been doing some digging into that. This is kind of following up on our conversation a week ago with Richard Ralston is with us. He is the executive director of Americans for Free Choice in Medicine, AFCM.org is their website. And this ties into the political campaigns right now. We have three Democratic candidates, arguably, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, who are suggesting that health care coverage should be mandatory. And sort of like car insurance. And Richard Ralston, not all that happy about that. AFCM.org. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good of you to cast some light on the issue.
Yeah. It really is sort of like with car insurance. First of all, give us your pitch on this.
Well, I think Obama is not doesn't want mandates except for children. But the absurdity of it.
Well, that's a mandate.
Yeah. But the absurdity of it is, of course, what is the point of mandating that you buy something that you can't afford, so that in the long run would go nowhere. The best possible case you can make for mandates is in Switzerland, where they mandate that everyone buy insurance. They can choose from at least 87 different insurance companies. But even there, 100,000 people aren't covered because they're not making their premiums, not paying their premiums. But right now, insurance is so expensive, and I'm no defender of the status quo. I think there's a lot of things we can do to make insurance more affordable. But just to mandate that people buy it if they can't afford it is like mandating that everyone buy a nice big house and take out a big expensive mortgage if they can't afford it.
Well, actually, if you want to draw comparisons or make analogies, I think a better one would be it's like mandating that everybody have auto insurance. And the reason why we have mandatory auto insurance in the United States, the primary reason is probably because the insurance companies lobbied for it. But, you know, the societal reason is because I don't want and you don't want your car to be hit by somebody who can't pay for the damage or, you know, God forbid something worse, who can't pay for it, who doesn't have insurance.
That's an important difference, yes. The liability is what they have to have.
Right. And similarly, in our society, I don't want to be sitting next to somebody on the bus or on the airplane who has active tuberculosis because they don't have insurance and can't afford to get treated. And so I would submit to you that mandating, and by the way, I'm not a fan of mandated insurance. I think we should have Medicare for all. I think it should be paid for out of our taxes, and we should simply have single-payer health system, which is not mandatory insurance. It's simply free insurance. It's simply there. But I can argue that mandatory health insurance is really no different than mandatory auto insurance in that the greater good is satisfied.
But even then, depending on the statistics you see, between 14% and 20% of drivers do not, in fact, have insurance. So it's very difficult, even in that limited context, to enforce that.
Thus the problem. So what do Americans for Free Choice in Medicine suggest is the alternative?
Well, the first thing to do is to take some simple steps that will start making the insurance more affordable. Obama has said that, you know, people don't not buy insurance because they don't want it, because they can't pay for it. Well, that's not quite true. The most effective, I think it would be unfortunate, but young people who are healthy would be forced to buy it, and their insurance wouldn't be very expensive anyway. But Massachusetts has found, and California is trying to figure out that it's just too expensive.
Yeah, this is Mitt Romney's program, is mandatory health insurance.
Yes, and
so,
I think from
so why not just get rid of the health insurance companies?
They're
taking 20 to 30% of all our health care dollars are going to companies that are not providing health care. They're simply leeches on the back of the health care industry. Why not get rid of them?
Why not get rid of the computer companies and the automobile companies?
Because computer companies and automobile companies actually produce something. Health insurance companies merely handle money between me and my doctor. I just as soon pay my doctor myself or pay it through a third party that is not interested in paying a $1.7 billion a year salary like William McGuire of United Healthcare got and is not paying dividends to its stockholders. If we're going to do it ourselves, we the people collectively, that's one of the reasons why we have this constitutionally limited representative democracy, a democratic republic. If we're going to do it ourselves, let's do it ourselves. Let's pay for it ourselves collectively so that we spread the risk among all of us, just like we do with Social Security. We simply make Medicare available to everybody in the United States.
Well, first let me say that I certainly agree that mandatory insurance would inevitably lead to that because it's unsupportable.
We don't have state financed car insurance.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with my insurance company if they know that I have to buy insurance from somebody.
Right. I'm in agreement with you. I think that this is a terrible weakness in the plans of the major Democrats. Although John Edwards, the giant loophole in his is anybody can buy into Medicare, which in effect over a 2 or 3 year period will put all the insurance companies out of business.
Yes, and of course Medicare cannot now finance its current obligations.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Medicare can't finance its current obligations because conservatives in Congress keep chopping away at the budget. I mean, here we had George Bush just vetoed the Children's Health Insurance Program, brilliantly named by the Democrats S-CHIP. Sounds like something you want to avoid as you're walking through a cow pasture. So it's not like, gee, the system doesn't work or it's broken. It's you've got people out there who are aggressively trying to break it. Why do you defend the existence of health insurance companies? Or are they funding your work?
No, I get no funding whatsoever from any insurance company or anyone in the healthcare industry.
Then why should we have, isn't there a time and place for government to do things? Don't you think that, for example, our police departments should not be privatized, that our school systems should not be privatized, that our fire departments should not be privatized? Why, if life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I would argue that life and the pursuit of happiness at the very least, and probably liberty, I don't know how free you are if you're so sick you can't drag yourself around, all could arguably be tied back to say that in the Constitution it says that we're all entitled to health care as a right, not a privilege.
No, that just means that you're not entitled to any health care at all unless you get it from the government.
But the government is us.
We are
providing it to us. The government,
the government is
them.
Politicians. The government is the California
We elected
Nurses
those politicians.
The question is, who gets the profit, the public employee unions or the companies?
The public employee unions don't make a profit off health care.
They spend millions of dollars on advertising, and they spend millions of dollars in contributions to politicians.
In large part to maintain their right to unionize. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing at all wrong with their right to unionize, but there's a problem with them with forcing everyone into a single government system, and they've got their hands around their throat.
So what you're suggesting is that a whole bunch of people, public employees, government employees, who are making middle-class salaries, middle-class pensions, middle-class savings and benefit programs, that when they lobby to maintain their existence, that's a bad thing. But when CEOs who are making hundreds of millions of dollars and who are representing stockholders who are taking billions of dollars out of the healthcare industry and putting it into their pockets, when they lobby, that's a fine thing.
Those are both bad things. The government should not be for sale to those that pay the biggest bribes to the government.
So then let's have publicly owned elections.
I can't imagine.
You can't have
that.
It both ways.
Let's spend a lot more money on the political campaigns. No, what we need is more freedom, and the first thing we need is to stop the enormous political burden on the insurance system and let the insurance companies compete with each other. So in California, you can't get affordable insurance because it's forbidden by law. You can't buy a policy from a cheaper company in Arizona. If you're, you know, in some states, if you're a nun, you have to buy a policy that pays for in vitro fertilization. So affordable insurance is forbidden by law in California and in many states. So we need to start getting those costs down as the first and easiest step to take.
To accomplish this, presumably.
Richard, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Richard Ralston, you can read about it over at afcm.org, the Executive Director of Americans for Free Choice in Medicine. Richard, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Tom. I loved it.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers. Speaking of health care here at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And I would argue that it has always been a right in the United States. It's just an unrecognized right, that it's a right that's written into the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, in my humble opinion. But many others say, no, even many Democrats. I find it mind-boggling that there are Democrats out there who are saying, let's keep the health insurance companies alive. It's a statement, frankly, not so much of democratic values. It's a statement of the power of money in politics. This really speaks directly to the need to reform politics. And by the way, it was Larissa Alexandrovna who was doing the reporting that I drew a blank on her name in the last segment. My apologies to you, Larissa. One of the best investigative reporters in America, and I'm a big fan of hers. In any case, the whole idea of insurance, the idea of insurance in the United States really came of age. As I recall, it was E.F. Stone who was the big promoter of it, and particularly of life insurance, back just after the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, you know, around 1900, 1910, 1920, sometime in that era. I'd have to go back and look at it. It's been 30 years or so since I read the biography of E.F. Stone, but he was a pretty amazing guy and, you know, a self-made millionaire, et cetera, et cetera. And basically his concept, not his concept, but the concept of insurance was that there are a lot of risks that are just too large for one person or one family to bear. The loss of your home, the loss of a breadwinner, for example, in a family. I mean, that was the one that Stone took on, as I recall, with life insurance. The confronting an illness for which there is a cure, but the cure costs hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. These are risks that the average person simply cannot bear. Well, actually, they're risks that, you know, I mean, if you want to play the lottery, as a pure risk, people will take, tragically. But when the occurrence happens, it wipes people out. You know, half of all bankruptcies in the United States right now are the consequence of medical bills. This is just so wrong. So the idea of insurance originally was, if we spread that risk over a large number of people, if thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people are sharing the risk, then when the statistically small number, when the small percentage of people who are actually whacked by these circumstances, their house burning down, you know, the loss of a breadwinner, a serious illness, when that happens, then that large number of people, well, it's only a buck out of everybody's pocket and everybody can deal with it. And that's why when Franklin Roosevelt was proposing known as the Social Security program, it was referred to very often as an insurance program, because it really is. It was an insurance program against disasters. It was about a third of all of Social Security goes to pay for literally widows, orphans, and disabled people. And about two-thirds of it is insurance against poverty and old age. both of which are societal ills that it's appropriate for us to collectively say, you know, we're going to insure ourselves against this. Now, there are some things that you might want to insure yourself against, and others might not. You know, the idea of death, for example. I'm not sure that I can build a strong case that everybody in the United States should pay into a fund that will pay a family if a person dies. Now, if a family's plunged into poverty, that, you know, they might become eligible for Social Security. So I suppose that there, to a certain extent, is a fund like that, because Social Security does cover widows and orphans. But for everybody to have life insurance, you know, for a 10-year-old kid to have life insurance, you know, it's kind of hard to build a case for that. That is something that, you know, it's up to individual families. But when we're talking about health, we're talking about the ability to survive, then it is only reasonable that everybody in the society share the risk, because that reduces the cost to everybody. Now, what that is going to require then is somebody to administer the program, somebody to take the money in and pay the money out. And the question before us in this election, the question before us broadly is the somebody who's going to take the money in and pay the money out to share that risk of catastrophic illness, is that somebody going to be a for-profit corporation that is going to skim anywhere from 10 to 30% or more off the top and share that money with its wealthy stockholders, or even its poor stock with its shareholders, and that's going to pay huge multi-million dollar salaries to its CEO and senior executives? Or is that entity going to be We the People? Is it going to be an agency of the government that is answerable to our elected officials, who every 2 years are answerable to us at the ballot box? And from, which is also known as single payer health care. And from my point of view, or Medicare for all, as John Edwards is as part of his proposal. And from my point of view, this is not rocket science. I see no reason why private health insurance companies, frankly, should even exist in the United States, unless it's to provide auxiliary insurance for the very wealthy who want to be able to have private jets on the way to the hospital. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour, and boy, oh boy, the cons are out. I'll tell you about that in just a second. First, just a heads up. As soon as I get off the air today here, I'm hopping on an airplane for Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm so looking forward to this. Friday night, I'll be at the University of Minnesota bookstore at Croft Memorial Union. And 7 o'clock, doing a rant on Cracking the Code, my new book, which, by the way, over at Amazon.com is number one in elections, number one in civics. What Would Jefferson Do, oddly enough, is number three in democracy. Number two in civics is my book, Screwed, number two in class. That's some kind of cool rankings. Even Unequal Protection, which I wrote a number of years ago, the book about the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case where the corporations rose up and took over America. Number five in consumer law on Amazon.com there. So some shameless plug, but some Christmas gift selections there. Ah, yes, it's time for our conservative alert for the day. Dear fellow conservative, comes the email that that I received this morning. The Washington Hollywood left is out of control. Their agenda threatens to damage our freedom, security, principles, and values. That's why I'm asking you for a tax-deductible gift to the Heritage Foundation, the nation's leading conservative think tank, to help counter their agenda. Learn more and help fight back at StopLiberalsNow.com. In recent week, the left, including judges, legislators, celebrities, and others, have stepped up its actions to lose the war in Iraq. Oh, my goodness. Actually, we'd like to stop the occupation. I think the war was won several years ago when we took down their government. That's the definition of winning a war. But anyhow, lose the war to whack by cutting funding for our troops and demanding immediate withdrawal. Hurt our ability to win the war on radical Islamic terrorism. There's a war. stop our nation from protecting its borders and curbing illegal immigration. What about the illegal employers? Teach inappropriate defensive sex education to kids even in lower elementary school. Oh, yes, we can't have them know about that. So the conservatives are at it again. And they say, and that's just the beginning. As conservatives, you and I must take a stand against this. The liberals are out of control. And we must firmly respond by giving our elected leaders and the American people the best research, et cetera, et cetera. So, if you're inclined, and you want to help the Heritage Foundation, StopLiberalsNow.com is their website. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And I see from my board here that Irvin in Oklahoma wants to say that George Bush was right and he should have vetoed the S-CHIP bill. What am I missing, Irvin?
I hate the bill.
You hate this bill? Why?
It's probably going to save the lives
of between 5 and 10,000 children this year.
I don't know anything about that. I'm calling in regards to insurance. I'm actually in Oklahoma now, but I live in El Paso, Texas. And I wanted to make a comment about the insurance that you're talking about. George Bush cut out the bill, and that was perfectly planned by the Democratic Party, which is not even true. Because you're not giving the whole story, Mr. Hartman. You're not telling reasons why he cut it. And number two...
Okay, why did Bush veto the S-CHIP bill, the state children's health insurance program?
It's not a state
why?
Health insurance children. It's not. It's not. It's
what is it, then?
It covers a person up to the age of 25, and TRICARE and CHAMP has never done that before. That's not a health insurance.
It is health insurance. It's just health insurance that extends, in some cases, with people who are very low income or who have disabilities beyond the age of what you and I might agree is childhood.
Is it supposed to be a child's bill? I don't consider a child at the age of 25.
There are very few 25-year-olds who would be covered under this bill, sir. Very, very few. There are some exceptions that have to do with where people live or how disabled they are or whether or not they have access to health care. But the vast majority of what this bill would go for are little kids. And Bush did not veto it because there are some exceptions in it for people who fall through the cracks. Bush vetoed it because he thinks it's socialism. He thinks that nobody should have federally provided health insurance. He thinks that this is the camel's nose under the edge of the tent. This is the beginning of socialized medicine in the United States. And he's opposed to it. It's the same reason why he ran against Social Security in 1977.
Well, actually, I kind of agree with you on that a little bit. But the thing is, the reason why he doesn't want, and you said you don't see any reason why the private sector should be in and should even exist, but you know for a fact we need these private sectors, because the reason why most people can't afford the insurance, health insurance, and I live in El Paso, Texas, all you have to do is come down to El Paso, Texas, because these companies are paying so much money for when it comes to prescription drugs because of illegal immigration. Well, we got a problem down there in El Paso.
You know, I will grant you, Irvin, that the immigration problem in the United States is a real problem, but it is not driving up health care costs in the United States. That is not the issue. In fact, people who are here illegally are far less likely to turn up looking for any kind of public services whatsoever.
Oh, please. Come on.
No, it's the statistics are readily available, and they're available from the Bush administration. Driving up the cost of health care in the United States is the fact that people like William McGuire are making $1.7 billion as a paycheck from the second largest health care insurance company in the United States. Now, I defy you to find any group of illegal immigrants who have cost us $1.7 billion in health care. That's just one guy, one of many leeches on the back of this system.
You know Sylvester Reyes, right?
I'm sorry, your phone, Irvin, I'm going to have to drop you. If you can get a better phone and call us back, I'd be pleased to put you on. But either you got me on a speakerphone or you got a lousy cell phone, and I can't hear what you're saying, and I know that our listeners are probably having a hard time too, but I'm pleased to have this kind of conversation with somebody who disagrees with me. Kent in Paris, France. Hey, Kent, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mr. Hartman, thanks for taking the call. I actually have books 1, 2, and 3 in that civics list you read out.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. What are you doing in Paris?
I've been living here for 6 years now, and through my job, I travel throughout Europe into Russia and other countries and do get to see the healthcare systems in those countries. And I think my main point for calling today is that there's so many fallacies in the arguments that I hear, people who oppose having, quote-unquote, socialized healthcare. And one of the big ones I hear over and over again is doctor choice. And in the full coverage countries that I tend to have the most experience in, especially France, you always have doctor choice. It's never an issue. So I
right, you can pick any doctor you want. It's what you don't have choice in is who pays the doctor, and that's because the government pays the doctor.
Sort of, but the cost is, depending on what kind of coverage you want, there's a basic coverage, which is basically you're not going to be left out in the cold coverage
right.
that the government handles, plus more. And if you want to add other things, special medicines and things on top of that, there's private insurance, and there's a lot of participation from your company that will help offset those costs as well. And when you're talking about how this CEO gets a $1.7 billion paycheck and all of these people are leeching off the system, it just amazes me that this is a valid argument, that America, which has always been very strong and seeing a good idea and appropriating it, either making it their own, such as, you know, cinema. We didn't invent that, but we made it huge. Everyone thinks cinema in America.
I thought Tom Edison invented cinema.
The Lumiere brothers in Lyon, Frère Lumiere, the Lumiere brothers in Lyon invented the cinema, film, you know, filming.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay.
But, you know, why can't we as Americans see a genius idea, again, like the automobile, and just say, hey, that's great, and we can do it either better or in our own way.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're so focused upon what I think is, I got to get mine mentality, as opposed to, how are we all doing together?
Yeah, yeah. And so, bottom line here, Kent, in Paris, France, are you happy with the health care that you get in France?
Oh, it's excellent. It's absolutely excellent. I broke my shoulder in August, and I was actually in Croatia when I did it. And, you know, it's covered. It's fine. You're going to be taken care of. Don't worry about it.
That's great. I think the Department of Homeland Security just discovered that we have an intercontinental phone call here, and because they're busting it up. But Kent, thanks a lot for the call.
I can hear that. Sure,
for
no
the
problem.
Heads up. Okay, good talking with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jim in Los Angeles. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay, I've got two challenges. First, you used the term right before talking about insurance, but what you're saying is that one group of taxpayers has a right to get money from another group of taxpayers because they have no money to buy their own insurance. And that's not my understanding of a right as the Constitution sets them.
No, what I'm saying is that when there are risks that exceed the ability of individual families, with the exception of maybe the top 1% of Americans, to deal with, that those risks should be spread among all of us.
Okay, now that's my second point. And that is, you're talking about insurance, and insurance has always been enacted to protect a group of people with a common hazard. Now, when you're saying, for example, I live in Los Angeles, and we don't have a problem in the city of Los Angeles, per se, with floods and forest fires. So why should I have to pay insurance into a group of people that have insurance against those things because they live in those risk areas? In health situations...
Because people in New Orleans can't afford to pay for rebuilding their community from scratch, because we're all in it together, because we're all Americans.
Okay, but wait a second. We're talking about New Orleans, and in New Orleans, that's a different situation because their insurance should be pooled with all people who have a flood risk.
Yeah, you can make that case. Again, you know, flood risks is something where I think you could argue that it's more, you can do it or not. But health, the ability to survive, not me. 45 minutes past the hour.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There, what you doing out there? Here in this men's room, these stall could be 10 rooms for romance.
And I'll be there tonight.
I can hear somebody going. I can hear the dryer blowing. You've got a flight soon, but I think I might soon have no pants. Oh, my sweetmeat, tap three times on the pipe if you want me. Twice on the pipe if you brought me a leash. Oh, my darling, means you'll meet me in the jetway. come on, knock on the door. If you're not the police.
Ah, yes. Yeah, this Bobby, flying into the Minneapolis airport tonight. So it's funny. Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ, where, by the way, on our in our presidential straw poll, it's down to two. At 620kpoj.com, it's down to two. That's my cat Higgins and Dennis Kucinich. And Higgins is holding his own. He's doing very respectably. So he was acting a little uppity this morning, and that must be why. Anyhow, I'll be flying into Minneapolis tonight to do a gig tomorrow night, and I'm looking forward to it. But Carl is a professional comedian as well as a talk show host. And last week, he was in Minneapolis. And he went to and when he flew through the Minneapolis airport, he went into a men's room. And as he came out, there was a shoe sign guy there. And he says, "Where's the Larry Craig men's room?" And the guy says, "You just came out of it." And so Carl pulls out his camera and says, "You know, will you take my picture in front of the men's room?" And the guy says, "Sure." And he's taking Carl's picture. And all these people start crowding around going, "Oh, is this the man? Is this the I want my picture taken here." And it's amazing. Oh, my. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our AirAmerica blog as well. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, John, you're on the air.
Hey, I got a question. I was wondering then, on your proposal with the health care, would a guy be able to, like, go to, like, what the, would you be able to go to, like, a private hospital then if you choose to do so, if you didn't want to be in the social?
Yeah, this is, you know, there's a significant difference, and most Americans don't get it because they haven't traveled around and experienced it in different countries. There's a significant difference between the British system, which I call, you know, shorthand socialized medicine. It's not pure socialized medicine. But in England, in the United Kingdom, the government owns the hospitals, and the doctors are employees of the government. They're just full-time employees.
Would you be able to go to a private hospital if I wanted to pay for that or not?
You can do that. I believe you can do that in England. Certainly you can do that in Canada.
I'm wondering if a person could do that in the States then if they were to get by with the proposal of socialized
medicine. Well, see, I'm not proposing socialized medicine. I'm not a proponent of it. In France, they have single-payer health insurance. And in Germany, where I used to live, they have single-payer health.
I'm just wondering if that would be a possibility.
It is in all cases. Sure, they allow private competition.
Would that be dangerous? In the total application, everybody that had money would go to a private hospital. I'm just saying that's why it seems like it would just be an impossibility because you'd have two levels of hospital care, wouldn't you?
Well, you would if everybody didn't pay into it. See, if you could voluntarily say, "I'm going to go to private hospitals, therefore I shouldn't pay my taxes for," you know, it's like saying, "I'm going to be able to fund my own retirement, therefore
I
want to pay Social Security anymore."
I'm saying I wouldn't mind paying into it. I wouldn't care, but I'm saying at the same note, it wouldn't really matter whether people are willing to pay or not. One way or the other, you're going to have two different levels of hospital care.
Sure, and that's always going to be the case. There are, right now in the United States, you have concierge hospitals. You have doctors who will come to your home right now in the United States if you're willing to pay a large enough fee.
So it wouldn't be an improvement.
No, it would be a tremendous improvement. What I'm saying is, you know, you're always going to have very, very rich people creating essentially a separate world for themselves.
Is that
you're always
what
going to
have now? So you're just talking about lateral moves.
No, I'm talking about a dramatic improvement. And I have used the healthcare system in Germany. I've used the healthcare system in the United Kingdom.
You're talking about those other ones. I don't really care about those other ones. What we're dealing with is our current healthcare.
Okay, in the United States, we have a single-payer healthcare system, and we have socialized medicine. The socialized medicine program is called the Veterans Administration. The government owns the hospitals and employs the doctors.
My brother's a veteran, and he complains about it.
That's right, because the veterans are a small minority of Americans. Therefore, they don't have the political power to get the full funding that is necessary. And Medicare, again, also represents a small minority of Americans. And although it's better than nothing, it, again, doesn't have – if every American received Medicare, then you would have a system more like in France or in other countries where by and large, people are very happy with their systems, and they would never want to trade places with us in the United States with 50 million uninsured and 30 million who are underinsured and so on. I mean, it's just – this is not rocket science. I mean, just consider it for a moment. Jay in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Jay.
Ah, hi. You sort of made my point, but look, it's cost spreading is what it's about. Now, if you took all the money that is paid for health care, not the insurance, just for health care, and divided it by the population, you'd have a basic cost. there. I don't know what the figure is. I'm internet impaired, but it probably isn't that much.
The figure would be in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $6,000 per family per year. And right now we're paying around $11,000 per family per year for health and private health insurance.
Ah, good to know. I pay $10,000 for one person. The other thing is, you know, the poverty of spirit of these conservatives, you know, like the nun has to pay for in vitro fertilization. You know, what a terrible thing. You know, I'm sure I'm paying for a lot of Viagra.
Yeah.
You know, God bless.
I know. Jay, it's an absolute tragedy. Thank you very much for calling. I got to move along here. Get one more call in before we wrap up the hour. Nancy in Minneapolis. We have just a few seconds, Nancy. Quick one.
Hi. I wish everybody would just rent Sicko for...
I agree. You know, the iconic moment from that movie is where Michael Moore looks at the camera and says, the ultimate question here is, do we want to have a we society or a me society?
Right. I was going to say, a lot of people are saying we need more insurance companies to increase the competition. If that were true, like they have with computers, computers are fantastic because of all the competition.
Right.
It would be like I would choose, say, Dell for a computer company. I would send premiums in to Dell. And a computer analyst would say, okay, you need a new computer. So then I go to Dell and say, I need a new computer. They give me a phone and says, here, you have internet connection. I try that for a couple months, go back to the analyst. They say, no, you need something better. I go to Dell. They say, well, here's a laptop with a little memory. And
right.
That's the way the insurance companies are handling everything.
Yeah, it's the way that the insurance companies handle it is a mess, because there's a difference between having a computer and, as you correctly point out, between having a computer and your life being at stake. As somebody is having a heart attack and they're trying to decide what hospital to go to, they can't shop around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Here's the question I'd like to see posed to Republicans in the next debate. Which way would you prefer to croak? How do you want to die? Starvation or drowning? I mean, we're looking into the jaws of worldwide disaster here. With regard to global warming, we're looking into the jaws of economic disaster. We're looking into the jaws of the end of empire. I mean, there's all these potential, frankly, disasters that are all, in my opinion, all trackable back to policies that were either initiated by or are supported by the Republicans and the Republican Party. USA Today, front page, today, Greg Zoroya writing, a record number of soldiers have killed themselves this year, according to Army statistics showing confirmed or suspected suicides. The deaths occur as soldiers serve longer combat deployments, and the Army is spending $100 million on support programs. General George Casey, the Army Chief of Staff, told Congress last month, soldiers, families, and equipment are stretched and stressed. And then they show a graph going back to 2001 before George decided he was going to have his little war all the way up to now. And you see that the number of suicides the number of suicides in the military is just about doubled. This is an equivalent of 18.4 suicides per 100,000 people. This is the highest the Army has had since they started counting in 1980. And this is for a war, of course, that George Bush entirely wanted. In fact, even before he became president, he's talking to his biographer was talking about. So number one, you know, these policy disasters. Number two, bigger policy disasters. You know, what's going on with global warming? And number three, how are we going to care for ourselves, you know, collectively? How do we care for ourselves? Half of all bankruptcies are the result of medical bankruptcies, are the result of medical bills. And today, yesterday, the president says, no, he's going to cancel or he's going to veto the S-CHIP program. Congressman Chris Van Hollen is with us, representing the 8th District of Maryland. Congressman Van Hollen, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be with you, Tom.
Tell us about this veto.
Well, look, this is the second, third time the president's vetoing this legislation. It is, I think, a real miscarriage of justice. These are about 10 million kids who were trying to make sure that they get health insurance. We already have a children's health insurance program, and these kids are already eligible for coverage, but we haven't been providing the resources. So we came up with a plan that would make sure that they got the resources to get the coverage they need. These are kids from, people who are being squeezed economically, families that are squeezed economically. There's a Medicaid program for kids from families below the poverty level, but there are lots of struggling families out there who are looking for just a little bit of help to make sure their kids get health insurance. And the way we funded it was by increasing the federal tobacco tax. So once again, the president has come down on the side of the tobacco companies, in this case against the kids' health program. In fact, last time the Republican members of the House were over at the White House, they came out saying, look, the president said, if you're funding this with a tobacco tax increase, we're not going to support it. So it's another example of siding with special interests against health care for kids. And I must say, we postponed the vote to override the president's veto till after the Christmas break so that people have an opportunity to talk to their members of Congress, those who voted with the president last time. We want them to really think about what they're doing, so that when we come back, we can try again to override that veto.
And over at callcongress.org, there's a list of toll-free numbers that you can use to call to get to the switchboard on Capitol Hill. If you're not sure who your member of Congress is, everybody has one member of the House of Representatives and two United States Senators. And I believe you're having the override problem would be in the House and not the Senate. Is that right, Congressman?
That's correct. There's bipartisan support for this. We saw Senator Grassley, Senator Hatch supporting it. A number of House Republicans supported it, but to get the override, we need two-thirds vote, which means we need another 16 Republican members to decide to stand up for kids' health rather than standing in blind loyalty to the president and whatever ideological or pro-special interest group agenda
and the tobacco companies. Yeah, so go to callcongress.org and get a phone number, get one of the toll-free numbers there, and call. And if you're not, as I said, if you're not sure who your member of Congress is, just give them your zip code, and they'll tell you. And you know, it's great to be in contact with these folks on a regular basis. Congressman, two quick questions about this. One, in the last hour, I was going off on this, and some conservative called up and said, well, this program covers people up to 25 years old. How can you call it a children's program? And I, you know, my response was there are exceptions. You know, there are also income exceptions, but they're very specific. They're state, you know, on a state by state basis. What's your rebuttal to that, or any details that you can give us to rebut that kind of commentary?
Yes, this is a very important understand. 90%, a little over 90% of the people covered under this program are kids under 18 years old with families that have incomes between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty level. That translates into a family income of about $42,000 for a family of four.
Or less.
Or less, right. So that's 90% of the people covered under this program. Now, under the existing program, and one that had been supported for years and years by President Bush, states could seek a waiver to cover kids from families up to 300% of the federal poverty level, which is about $60,000 for a family of four, or they could include some parents of kids. This new bill actually limits what has already been allowed under the existing program that the president supported. We do continue to allow waivers up to 300%, but we no longer allow waivers up to 400% of poverty. And this is another point that needs to be clear. No state has ever gotten a waiver up to 400% of federal poverty level. New York State, because of the high costs, applied for one. They were said that they were denied that. And in fact, in the new legislation we've got, we prevent states from seeking coverage for families above 300% of federal poverty level. They can seek a waiver because many states the cost of living is much higher than any others, up to 300%, but that waiver will have to be approved by the Bush administration when they're in office and follow-on administrations later on. But the overwhelming amount of this financial support for health insurance goes to families who are between $22,000 for a family of four and $42,000 of a family.
Okay. And Congress,
let me just say one thing, because we paid for this. We paid for it At the same time, the president's saying no to $35 billion over 5 years that is paid for entirely by a tobacco tax. He's asking the Congress for another $200 billion a year for the war in Iraq that's going on the national credit card and will be paid for by future generations. So
with interest.
With interest. I mean, it's we call it the debt tax. I mean, right now, every American is going to have to be paying about $3,000 just to pay off the interest on the debt each year.
Right. The vast majority of which was run up under three Republican presidents, Reagan, Bush, and Bush. Congressman Van Hollen, the final question. The Clear Skies Initiative makes our skies dirtier. The Healthy Forest Initiative makes our kills off our forests. Nonetheless, these things are brilliantly named. Why couldn't the Democrats come up with a name that doesn't sound like something you want to avoid when you're walking through a cow pasture?
Well, that's a good question. I think we all need to do a much better job in terms of message. This is actually a name that was inherited from this program, which was developed on a bipartisan basis in the 1990s, and it was the Children's Health Insurance Program. And my God, maybe we should come up with a name that lets people know more quickly exactly what it's all about. But
yeah, save our children or
providing,
something.
Providing 10 million American kids who aren't getting health care coverage right now with a little bit of extra money so that they can afford it.
Yeah, we should call it 10 million points of light, or if we know that statistically it's probably going to save the lives of 10,000 children a year, 10,000 children alive, or, you know, the Save Our Children program or something. I don't know, but, you know, you guys are very creative. I hope that when you bring this back, you can come up with a little bit, or just, you know, call it the Children's Health Insurance Program, I suppose, but not use the acronym.
Yeah, hey, I think you're right.
Yeah, Congressman Chris Van Hollen, representing and very ably representing the 8th District of Maryland. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us today.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Good talking.
And I hope everyone will call in and let their members know over this upcoming break that it's important to stand with the kids and override the veto. January 23rd will be the date of the veto override.
Yeah, so go to callcongress.org to get the phone numbers. The main switchboard number is 202-225-3121. Ask for your member of the House of Representatives, especially if it's a Republican, oddly enough, and say, hey, listen, this S-CHIP program, this Children's Health Insurance program, vote for it! Congressman Van Hollen, thank you.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
I know this evening now deals a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and
. 21 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. So back to the original question of the hour. Now that we have figured out that, you know, one of the simple ways that we should care for ourselves God forbid disaster fall, is with a single-payer healthcare system or something better than what we have right now, where these giant leeches called health insurance companies are sucking all the blood out of us. How do we avoid the disasters that we're looking at, whether they're economic disasters, whether they're global climate disasters? Al Gore at the UN Bali Climate Conference today.
Just this week, new evidence has been presented. I remember years ago listening to the scientists who specialize in the study of ice and snow express concern that sometime toward the end of the 21st century, we might even face the possibility of losing the entire North Polar ice cap. I remember only 3 years ago when they revised their estimates to say it could happen halfway through the 21st century, by 2050. I remember at the beginning of this year, when I was shocked, along with others, to hear them say it could happen in as little as 34 years. And now, this week, they tell us it could completely disappear in as little as 5 to 7 years. One of the victims of the horrors of the Third Reich in Europe during World War II wrote a famous passage about the beginnings of the killings. And he said, first they came for the Jews, and I was not a Jew, so I said nothing. Then they came for the gypsies, and I was not a gypsy, and I said nothing. And he listed several other groups, and with each one he said nothing. And then he said, and then they came for me. For those who have believed that this climate crisis was going to affect their grandchildren and still said nothing, and who were shaken a bit to hear that it would affect their children, still said and did nothing. It is affecting us in the present generation.
Al Gore at the climate conference in Bali. Former President Gore, the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States, also said that it is the United States government that is doing the obstruction. As far as I could tell, this wasn't a speech he was reading, and thus his quote of Pastor Niemöller was just a little bit off. As I recall, it was first they came for the communists, and then they came for the trade unionists, or maybe it was the other way around, but and then on down. But nonetheless, the point was well taken, and it got him a standing ovation. Rapturous applause and cheers. He said, in fact, my own country, the United States, is principally responsible for obstructing progress in Bali. The good news here, I guess, is that there's 403 days, 10 hours, 28 minutes, and 3 seconds left before George W. Bush leaves the White House. Voluntarily. Presumably. Barring impeachment. There is new evidence, the Center for American Progress reporting that General Hayden lied. A former prisoner claims that his torture was taped in 2003. Hayden had claimed that the videotaping of torture was stopped in 2002. I don't know. Maybe these guys are just into S&M and they're creating tapes for themselves. Who knows? Steve Heating needs, back to the issue, you know, global climate change. Soaring fuel prices are creating a crisis among low-income people. Judy Keene in USA Today today, and senior citizens who can't afford to heat their homes, say local agencies that distribute food heating or federal heating subsidies. This is the LIHEAP program, another brilliantly named program by the Democrats, the Low-Income Housing Assistance Program, heating and energy assistance program, LIHEAP. And costs up this year, this is from the Energy Information Administration, the U.S. Department of Energy's analytical arm, says the average U.S. household will pay $986 this year, up 10.9% from last year. Residential heating oil is expected to average a 30% increase over last year. So the costs are going up, but the Bush administration, oh, no, you send us something that's going to help out folks with that, and we will veto it. At the same time, in the New York Times, some of these headlines are downright spooky. Bankers face grim truth. Worst is yet to come. Michael de la Merced writing in the Marketplace section of the New York Times yesterday. The worst is yet to come, the credit crisis. Which raises a lot of interesting questions. One has to do with sovereign wealth funds. Our country is being bought up, but it's not being bought up by capitalists. It's being bought up by countries with whom, in many cases, we have very dicey relationships. China, some of the countries of the Middle East. And whether Michael Bloomberg is going to get into the election. I want to share something about that very briefly with you, in a thoughtful piece by Ben Castleman in the Wall Street Journal, and we'll take your calls right after this break.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Oh, brother, I can't get through. I've been trying hard to reach you, 'cause I don't know what to do. Oh, brother, I can't. I'm so scared about the future, and I want.
34 minutes past the hour. Interesting, over at the Washington Post, Jonathan Weissman and Paul Kane writing the headline, Democrats blaming each other for failures. There's a great quote from Charlie Rangel, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, who says that Democratic leaders are developing Stockholm Syndrome. This is where you identify with your captor. It's the one of the most effective ways to interrogate somebody, actually. Rangel saying Stockholm Syndrome among the Democrats in the House and Senate. Harry Reid, in turn, has taken to the Senate floor to criticize what he called the speaker, that would be Nancy Pelosi's iron hand style of governance. Democrats in each chamber are now blaming their colleagues in the other for the mess in which they find themselves. Their predicament caused the majority party yesterday to surrender to President Bush on domestic spending levels, drop a cherished renewable energy mandate, and move toward leaving a raft of high-profile legislation from addressing the mortgage crisis to providing middle-class tax relief undone or incomplete. Rangel says, if there's going to be a filibuster, let's hear the damn filibuster. Let's fight this damn thing out. Yeah, it's the same thing Bernie Sanders said on the show a couple of weeks ago. You know, if the Republicans want to call a filibuster, they shouldn't just say, we're filibustering. And Harry Reid says, okay, we'll move on. I mean, it was the Republicans, you'll remember, 3 years ago who were talking about the nuclear option, who were saying, if the Democrats dare to filibuster, then we're going to blow up the filibuster. We're going to do away with it. Come on, Harry. Get a spine. You're a Marine. You know how to do it. 866-303-2270, your phone number. Jeremy in Huntington, California. Hey, Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? If I might have about 45 seconds, I called Rohrabacher here in Huntington Beach, California. I asked him what his contention with the ESPA was, and he said, one, that it pays for illegal immigration health care, and two, he doesn't think it provides health care for only poor children. So I suggested perhaps that we bill Mexico for any services paid for illegal immigration. Secondly,
That's a good one.
So, yeah, I haven't read it, actually, which shame on me. And I wonder how many members of Congress actually have most cases. But anyway, also, I wonder if there's anyone actually doing anything about the FCC letting people just buy up the media. You know, Feinstein writes me and says, well, we're making sure that local coverage is covered before we actually approve.
Well, the problem you've got is Kevin Martin, the chairman of the FCC. The FCC, has it's a five-person panel, basically, and the president gets to appoint two plus the leader. And so he's got two Democrats, two Republicans, but the guy who's the head, Kevin Martin, is even more incompetent than Colin Powell's son, who was the previous guy.
And the problem is in local coverage. Frankly, the local coverage in my district is a joke. When you compare it to, like, cable media, I mean, it's absolutely like, you know, Pravda or something. But my problem is I don't want any one person owning all information that we get, or five people or five companies or whatever, you know?
Yeah, this is much bigger. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say this is much bigger than radio or television. In fact, the thing that's contentious right now is whether a company, you know, if Rupert Murdoch owns the radio station in town and owns the TV, the biggest radio station in town, the biggest TV station in town, should he also own the only newspaper in town? I think it's a certain point you have to invoke the Sherman Antitrust Act and say monopolies are pernicious, monopolies are destructive, and when monopolies are applied to the media, they're especially pernicious and destructive. Jeremy, thanks for the call and thanks for your point. Lynn in Essex County, New Jersey. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
I'm just calling to say that as a smoker, I have called and written to my representatives in Washington and asked them not to vote for S-CHIP as it stands, because I feel there's no reason to tax a small segment of the population for a program that will benefit all of the population. And smokers are tired of becoming the ATMs for every legislature that can't meet its budget.
Well, here's the argument, and let me preface this by saying, Lynn, I don't absolutely disagree with you. I think that to say that we're going to take something that is, you know, a sin tax essentially, and we're going to fund essential services with it is crazy. That we should simply raise taxes. You know, we should simply, you know, take the income tax back up to the 71% it was at for people making more than $3.2 million a year. When Reagan came into office, you know, the tax that Dwight Eisenhower thought was a very good and progressive income tax, the Republican, actually under Eisenhower was 91%, and pay for things with that. I mean, it was just straightforward. But here's the reason. Here is an argument that I think counters your argument. I'd like to hear your response to it. Your smoking is costing me, because when you get sick prematurely, as you probably will, or many of your peers will, or when your children get asthma, as they probably will if you smoke at home, I'm going to have to pay for that, either in higher health insurance premiums because we share an insurance company, or in higher taxes for Medicare or Medicaid if we're sharing that. And so if I'm having to pay for the added health care costs associated with a habit that you have, which, tobacco is the only product in our society that when used as directed causes death. It's the only one. Its only purpose is ultimately the only thing, that, you know, cars, you could say, well, people die in car accidents. Yeah, but cars actually provide transportation. So I would say that to take a product that is burdening our healthcare system and use it to pay for our healthcare system at least has some small semblance of rationality associated with it.
Well, I think that that holds true for any segment of the population that engages in risky behavior. I mean, why not tax skydivers and motorcycle riders?
You do.
As
we
obsessively
do.
As we do smokers.
We do. As a pilot, I can tell you that my life insurance premiums are much higher. And I used to be a skydiver. I broke my back the third time I was skydiving. And so I haven't since then. But I can tell you that when I was an active pilot, my health insurance premiums were much higher. I was paying for that.
Well, many smokers are paying higher premiums through their employee health plan. But, for instance, I'm a smoker who has no health care, yet I'm expected to pay for children.
So I'm going to pay for your
health
care.
That I don't have. No, I have no health care.
So if you end up in a hospital emergency room, I'm going to pay for it.
Not necessarily.
What? I don't pay taxes?
Not necessarily, because this was the argument given when they passed the MSA, that they would use the money to help pay the Master Settlement Agreement that brings you...
Right.
Through the back door, all of these.
I thought that argument was that the money that they got from the tobacco companies was going to be used to run advertisements encouraging people not to smoke.
Yes, well, half of the money goes to advertisements put out by people like Ash and Gasp and New York Quits, and the other half of the money goes into the state legislative pockets to do with as they will.
I see.
And, for instance, in New Jersey, they claimed that signing on to the MSA would help to fund health care for smokers who had no health care. And 2 years later, they used it to fund the health care provided to state workers.
Yeah. Lynn, this is where, as I said, at a certain level, probably you and I agree. I think it's a shame that schools are having to depend on lotteries. I think it's a shame that health care has to depend on taxing tobacco. Frankly, I think that lotteries and tobacco are both pernicious. Speaking as a former smoker myself, I have some sympathy for your position, or some empathy, rather. But the bottom line is that in this environment where the Republicans for the last 30 years have convinced Americans that taxes are an evil thing, that we don't have an obligation to pay for our civil society collectively, and they have decreased the corporate share of taxes from about half of the total tax load in the United States, which meant that the middle class was actually paying very little tax relative to what they were earning back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, to the point where corporate taxes now account for about 7 or 8% of total federal income. And the top 1%, were paying 71% income taxes. Now they're paying 30%, and if they earn most of their living from dividends and interest, they're paying a maximum of 15%. What that means is that the middle class in America has picked up most of the load of taxes, and so they're very sensitive to raising taxes. We need to completely redesign this system. We need to fix the system, take it back to a system before the Republicans broke it. But given the fact that it's so badly broken and that the Republicans have enough power in the Senate to filibuster legislation and enough power in the House to not have things be veto-proof, and you've got a Republican in the White House, this is the only option we have.
Well, I can't argue with you at all about corporations not paying their fair share of the tax, and that the very wealthy have been given all the tax breaks under the Bush administration, and the burden is placed on the middle class. But smokers are very much in the demographic of middle class. We're the folks that are suffering financially to begin with. Why penalize us because we use an unpopular product?
Well, in part, I think the logic is, as I said, A, because we're paying for your health expenses anyway, and B, we'd like to encourage you not to do that.
I think that can be proven, that can be disproven, because if you go to websites like smokersclubinc.com and forces.org.
Lynn, do you work for the tobacco?
Because you're mine. I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Now, if only George and the Republicans would say that about the Constitution. You know, wouldn't that be nice? Every Thursday at this time, we bring online an advertiser on one of our local affiliates to, A, you know, give them a good on you, a tip of the hat to them for advertising on our local stations, and also to let them tell their story about the success that they've had advertising on Progressive Talk Radio. Today, Burke Lewis is with us. He's the Senior Clinical Associate with Addiction Recovery Professionals. And also runs a local show, a weekend show, Next Step, at KTNF 950 Air America, Minnesota. His website is ARP Recovery.com, ARP Association Recovery Professionals, ARPRecovery.com. Burke, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom.
I'm pleased to have you here. We're going to keep this short, just down to 2 minutes. If you just give me 1 minute on, tell us what Addiction Recovery Professionals is all about.
Well, we're a private practice agency dealing with a number of issues around chemical dependency and other addictive behaviors. We do assessment, intervention, post-treatment care, case management, family counseling and individual counseling, and clinical transportation. So we run the gamut through the services. Basically everything but primary treatment is what we're doing in Twin Cities. So, and we travel all over the country. We do our work not only locally here in the Twin Cities, but wherever the need arises. So,
well, we just had a caller a few minutes ago who's addicted to nicotine. Do you deal with that as well?
We do. You bet. And again, we don't do the treatment itself for the nicotine addiction, but we do the whatever front-end services may need to be done and support services afterwards or for the family. And we refer a ton of people for nicotine addiction. So.
Okay. Burke, how has advertising on Air America Minnesota, KTNF 950, worked for you?
Well, it's worked reasonably well. We've run through a couple different ads. We have about 4 minutes of time on the show itself and then some time throughout the day. And it's generated phone calls throughout the course of our time, especially in the last year or so,
mm-hmm.
Where we've built up the reputation not only for the program but for the business. And what's been extraordinarily helpful is having a precept before even talking to the folks where they're willing to engage us in our services because they've listened to the program or they've heard one of our guests or they've found out something they needed to know directly from the programming. So we get direct calls and indirect referrals.
Great. Burke Lewis, ARPRecovery.com is the website. He's a senior clinical associate with the Addiction Recovery Professionals, advertising at KTNF 950 Air America, Minnesota. Burke, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Good talking with you. 53 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Charlie, another angry smoker. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine.
I'm not an angry smoker, do you say? No.
Well, my call screening stuff here says Charlie Rochelle Park, New Jersey, another angry smoker. Sorry.
No, but I agree with the last caller. I mean, you know, we smoke, we know it's bad for us.
Right.
But, you know, it's...
And
it's,
if you don't have health insurance, I'm paying for the bill.
Right, and, you know, and granted, you know, you said your life insurance was higher as a pilot, but that's your life insurance.
Right.
I mean, you know, pilots who get hurt, you know, in a crash or skydivers or whatnot. My question, though, is why is it always cigarette taxes? Why aren't they talking about taxing alcohol, which occupies a higher portion of the healthcare dollar?
Well, alcohol is a product that, when used as directed, doesn't cause death.
Alcohol is a poison, basically.
Alcohol, actually, there's a fair amount of scientific research that indicates that people who consume moderate amounts of alcohol throughout their lives, not just red wine, just alcohol itself, apparently, they consume moderate amount of alcohol through their lives, live longer. And so, you know, alcohol can be abused, just like driving a car can be abused or flying an airplane can be abused. But alcohol is not a product that, when used as directed, causes death. Only tobacco, of all the products in our society, falls into that category.
Well, you know, okay, that's true. I mean, granted, and that's true. But it seems to me kind of a facile statement. I mean, alcohol can be a positive thing, but in most cases, it's not, and
yeah.
I think we can agree with that.
Well, it can and is abused. And by the way, alcohol is heavily taxed. And but Charlie, let me just say, as I said to our last caller, I agree with you, and I'm going to have to drop it. Charlie, thanks for the call. I got to drop the call because the echo is making me crazy. But I agree with you that this is the worst way to pay for health care. It's the absolute worst way. We should be paying for health care with just, you know, a basic, it should be part of progressive income taxation. We're all in this together. We're all chipping into the fund. We're all using from the fund. That's how it should be. But because of the corrosive, cancerous influence on the body politic of America of conservative think tanks and the conservative politicians over the last 30 years, they've made it virtually impossible to even talk about even rolling back tax cuts like Bush's tax cut. I mean, the Democrats had a piece of legislation here recently where they were saying, let's do away not investment bankers, but these arbitrage guys. They're paying a maximum 15% income tax. You know, the Blackstones of the world, they're paying a maximum 15% income tax because they're arguably making their money from interest and dividends. And they're making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And so let's just take them up to pay the same income tax that everybody else, the Bill Gates pays, the same income tax rate in the 30s that everybody else pays. They couldn't get that past the Senate. I mean, this is how sick and twisted it has become. And so if smokers want to redirect their rage at somebody, it should be directed at the conservatives and the conservative think tanks, you know, and just go on down the list from the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, to the Competitive Enterprise Institute, you know, on down the list. That's where your anger should be directed, because they have so warped and twisted and distorted the system that we can't reasonably and rationally raise funds the way we should. And so we have to come up with these rationalizations. And frankly, I agree. That's what it is, of hitting smokers for health care. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. I've been talking for actually a couple of years now about the Don Siegelman disaster down. In fact, I wrote about it at least 3.5, 4 years ago, just about the theft of the election in an op-ed piece for CommonDreams.org. When it happened. Dan Abrams tonight on his Live with Dan Abrams, MSNBC's program, the one that follows Keith Olbermann's show on most, you know, in most communities, is going to be taking this on. And he's going to be taking it on by bringing on Scott Horton, who has written about this for Harper's Magazine, one of the best pieces I've seen, one of the best roundup pieces. We had Larissa Alexandrovna writing about it in Raw Story. We're talking with her about this last week. Scott's piece in Harper's is brilliant and really frames the large picture. Harper's.org is the website if you want to see that over there. And Scott Horton on the line with us today. Scott, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. And you know, congratulations on getting Dan Abrams and MSNBC to take a serious look at this. That's a marvelous step. Give us the elevator speech here, the thumbnail on what happened.
Well, it's a political prosecution from the outset. We know that now very clearly, and we've gotten a deep inside view to what went on within Republican circles to set it up. We know that Karl Rove was involved. We know the governor of Alabama, a number of other elected officials were involved, and they coordinated all this with the Justice Department and two prosecutors.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. First of all, I have been saying for some time now that we shouldn't be paying attention to the nine federal prosecutors who got fired. We should be paying attention to the rest of them who didn't get fired. What were they doing that caused them to keep their jobs? Apparently, that's what's going on in Alabama. And so here we have a Democratic sitting governor who runs for re-election, and when he goes to bed at night is told that he has won the election. What happened then?
Well, he gets up in the morning and discovers because of a shift in the most Republican county of the state, Baldwin County, he's lost it by 3,000 votes. And that is, in the words of statisticians who studied the case, not improbable, impossible.
Right. Okay. So Don Siegelman is confronted, the sitting governor of Alabama is confronted with the possibility that the election was stolen from him by the Republican. I've forgotten his name now.
Bob Riley.
Bob Riley. Thank you very much. By Bob Riley. Bob Riley's campaign manager is the husband of whom?
Is the husband of Laura Canary, who's the prosecutor who brings the case against Siegelman.
What a surprise. And she's one of the federal prosecutors who was put into place by Gonzalez and or by the Bush administration, kept into place by Gonzalez. And Karl Rove gets involved in this.
Deeply. I think, you know, the information we have coming out now, and there's quite a bit being developed, including by Larissa Alexandrovna, who you mentioned, we've got him going back to the beginning of this plan, and we have one Republican operative lawyer who gave testimony before the House Judiciary Committee in which she describes a whole series of meetings with Karl Rove in which he's agitating for this prosecution, planning it, plotting out how it will be done, how it will be timed to maximize benefit for the Republican Party in a gubernatorial election in Alabama.
Is that not in and of itself a crime?
Absolutely, it is. And today, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted a contempt citation against Karl Rove, and that's over his failure to turn over his emails and correspondence. I think, you know, the reason that they're pursuing a scorched earth strategy, refusing to provide this information, is that it would document some of this, I think. Yeah, we'd see evidence of the communication and the chain. That's the reason why they will go down rather than give up this information.
Right, because otherwise they go to prison.
That's right.
Now, what specifically are the laws that Karl Rove would have broken and that Mrs. Canary would have broken in the context of this in prosecuting the former governor of Alabama, arguably the governor of Alabama, and getting him out of the way? Is it just the Smith Act or the Hatch Act? Or
well, the Hatch Act has to do with employing people, but this is basic corruption of the entire justice process. So it's illegal for a prosecutor to bring charges and pursue them for political purposes. But in this case, we've also got a specific statute that says that a U.S. attorney cannot be involved in and prosecute a matter where there is an obvious appearance of impropriety. And in this case, of course, her husband's managing the campaign against Governor Siegelman, and she is fueling that campaign with its strongest attack ads by conducting this criminal investigation and prosecuting it. So there's a federal statute that makes her handling the case completely illegal. In fact, would require her removal and perhaps her prosecution for having done what she in fact did.
Right. She should have recused herself at the very least.
Now, she claims to have recused herself 8 months into the process after it's already up and launched. But, you know, my sources, including sources within her office, tell me that was a complete scam. She never dropped out of it. She's continued to be deeply involved with it all along. In fact, instead of having a new U.S. attorney come in and manage it, the head of her prosecutorial group has handled it, someone who is directly accountable to her, gets his paycheck from her, gets his performance evaluations from her. So she's manipulating this case from behind the scenes.
This is the kind of stuff that used to happen in the Soviet Union. People being put, and is again in Russia, people being put in prison because they dared to speak out politically.
Well, I spent a large part of my career working in the former Soviet Union defending dissidents. Andrei Sakharov was one of my clients. And making the comparison, I would say the abuses I see are more shocking in many respects than things I saw in Russia.
Really? Why?
Well, the nature of the charges that are brought, The way he was thrown in prison, we see a sort of show trial aspect to it. Most people, when they think of Russia, of course, think of the dramatic things that happened in the 1950s under Stalin. But when you get much later into the 70s, the Brezhnev period, things got very, very subtle and sophisticated.
Right. Yeah, and they use things like mental illness more often than... in any case, we're talking with Scott Horton, Harper's.org, Harper's Magazine. He's written a piece for Harper's about the political prisoner in the United States, Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama. Why, Scott will be tonight on Dan Abrams, MSNBC Live with Dan Abrams, and I encourage you to watch it. I've already set our contraption to record the thing. Scott, why can't I get Governor Siegelman on this program? Why can't people talk with him?
The Justice Department has treated him like the man in the iron mask. No one can see him or talk to him. Journalists cannot record conversations with him, conduct interviews with him. He's off grounds now.
But this guy's not a serial murderer. I mean, what was he convicted of?
He was convicted of political corruption, of having accepted a campaign contribution from an insurance executive, and then having appointed that executive to an uncompensated advisory board in Alabama. And by the way, if that's a crime, then let's look at the 146 officials of the Bush administration who were appointed to high federal positions after contributing $100,000 or more, or raising that money.
Right, virtually all our ambassadors.
Exactly, virtually all of them, yeah, or a large number of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So the crime that Don Siegelman committed was he took a campaign contributor and put him on an advisory board that is not paid. In other words, he asked a campaign contributor to volunteer his time to help the state.
That's right. And I interviewed a half dozen criminal prosecutors who specialize in corruption cases. They all said no prosecutor exercising independent judgment ever would have brought this case. It's a political contrivance from the beginning.
But the guy has been convicted, and he is so locked down in prison that he can't talk to the media. He can't get out on bail. Is there an appeal? Is there an appeal going on?
Well, the appeal is also blocked because there's no transcript from the case. The judge has a responsibility to be sure that a transcript is prepared. You know, we're now 2 years after this trial, coming up on that, and there is no transcript ready from the trial.
Of the trial.
That's right. And the judge, there was a motion made for his release on bond pending appeal, and the judge refused to make an order to justify his decision not to release him. The 11th Circuit has now twice issued instructions to this judge to rationalize his decision. He refuses to.
Is the judge a Republican crony also?
The judge is not only a Republican crony, he was a member of the Republican Executive Committee in Alabama, just appointed to the bench through Karl Rove and George Bush. He's someone who had an open and public grudge against Siegelman, wouldn't recuse himself. And we also know he was a member of the Republican Party's Executive Committee in Alabama and was involved in elections opposing Siegelman.
The Republican Party is running like a mafia. And are they moving him from prison to prison so that he can't be kept track of and the press can't talk to him, Siegelman?
Well, they did that at the beginning. Now he's in Oakdale, Louisiana, though. He's settled down.
Amazing. Scott Horton, check it out tonight on MSNBC with Dan Abrams, Live with Dan Abrams. Read about it in Harper's Magazine. You can pick it up on the stands or harper's.org. Scott, a tip of the hat to you. Great work you're doing. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Great to be with you.
Keep it up. Keep it up. 16 minutes past the hour. Political prisoners in the United States. That's how far we've gone.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Minutes past the hour. Time for our best of the rest of the news segment, where we go out and check out the tubes, not the trucks. What's going on the internets? Jade Hampshire with us, our blogger for the day. She's the founder of FireDogLake.com. FireDogLake.com, of course, the website. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you here with us again. Actually, you've been here many times. What do you see as the biggest stories of the day right now?
People
at least
today
from the point of view of your website.
people today are talking about Bill Shaheen's comments about Barack Obama. As the co-chair of Hillary Clinton's New Hampshire campaign, he came out and asked, since Obama had admitted to cocaine use when he was a teenager, he said, well, you know, people are going to be asking him like he wasn't, you know, has he ever dealt drugs? And people thought that was a pretty dirty tactic. So there's been a lot of blowback about that.
You know, in a way, actually, this could be a gift to Barack Obama in as much as it would allow him to get the denial on the record and the statement on the record, because if you think Hillary is going to play dirty, wait until you see the Republicans.
Well, that's kind of what I thought. You know, it allows him to do what the Republicans do so often, which is to say, oh, it's old news. We've talked that already. Once it becomes.
Well, that's what George Bush did. I mean, you know, he got hit when during the primary with the issue of his being drunken and his drunk driving arrest and all this other stuff. And well, actually, that came up before the general election. But he got you know, a lot of his alcoholism and his military service and everything came up during the primaries. The one issue that never came up, which frankly surprised me, was his arrest for cocaine as a teenager and his father, you know, when he became governor, getting that pulled out of the records and things. But, you know, Bush then later on said, hey, this is old news. Why doesn't Barack Obama take that opportunity right now?
Well, people are seeing it also as, you know, the Clinton camp running a more conservative campaign. She also joined with Joe Lieberman this week to, you know, sort of flag a scolding figure about Manhunt 2 video game. So, you know, trying to paint Obama as, you know, someone with a cocaine issue while she runs the center seems to be a larger tactic.
I just don't see where appearing with Joe Lieberman would help any Democrat. Am I missing something really big here? I mean, you know, in the logic arena, or
does she need to remind somebody that she voted for Kyle Lieberman? I mean, that was when she started tanking in the polls. She shouldn't be following Joe Lieberman around. It may, you know, maybe Mark Penn isn't showing up in a micro trend, but you know, the people who are sort of watching the big picture might advise her not to be following Joe Lieberman.
Right. The other dimension of that is, you know, where is John Edwards in the mainstream media? He is over the last few months. It has astounded me as his name recognition in the national polls. Because frankly, the national polls, in my opinion, do not measure how somebody's going to vote. They measure name recognition. Mm-hmm. As his name recognition has fallen, I'd say it's the direct consequence of the fact that he is simply never ever mentioned in the corporate media in the United States. And why would they? I mean, the guy made his living taking down corporations.
Well, and it's been tough for either Obama or Edwards to meaningfully form, an identity as an opposition candidate because they take away from each other. If either one of them was in the race alone, it would be Hillary Clinton insider, the other one outsider. But because it's the two of them, they split the vote, and Obama's just done a better job.
Yeah. What are the other big stories that you see over at FireDogLake.com?
Well, the other big story that's happening is the fight between the House and the Senate over the new appropriations bill.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dave Obey had, you know, as an appropriations chairman, had said, we're going to trim all the pork from the budget. We're not going to give Bush, we're going to observe Bush's desire to curb spending here, but we're not going to give him any money for Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're going to pull all the pork. And Harry Reid said, no, pork goes back in. So they're duking it out right now.
The House and the Senate.
Yes.
Democrats versus Democrats.
Democrats versus Democrats. Democrats in the House are saying, we pass all this legislation and we send it to you, and then it just goes down. You never make the Republicans filibuster.
Yeah.
And the Republicans are going, and the Democrats in the Senate are going, you don't understand the Senate, and you know, we have all of these rules that we have to follow, you know, and that they have to, basically we're up against the 40, you know, for the 41 vote thing.
Yeah, this is like fratricide. What do you see coming down the road here? We've got about 30 seconds, Jane. What do you see coming down the road?
The FISA battle tomorrow should be interesting. Will go up? Will it have telecom immunity or not? It should be a big battle on the Senate floor either tomorrow or Monday. Mm-hmm. And also the WGA strike. Those are the things we're going to be talking about.
The WGA strike. Give me explain.
The Writers Guild strike.
Oh, the Writers Guild. Thank you.
The Writers Guild strike that other unions are joining into. And on the same day that Les Moonves is going to, you know, sign the contract where he'll get $30 million next year, they're telling the writers that they can't have their share.
Right. Well, they're just workers.
They are. They're just workers.
You know, just, if you're just a worker in America, you're out on the outside. Okay, Jane Hampshire, the founder of FireDogLake.com, FireDogLake.com, the website. Thank you, Jane.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much for being here. Right now, time for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Today's question for our pop quiz. In yesterday's Republican presidential debate, how many times did the candidates mention George W. Bush's name? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-303-2270. 1-866-303-2270 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The answer coming up right after the break.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, we're going to get to one of my favorite people in just a second, but first, congratulations. We have a winner in our Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for today was, in yesterday's Republican presidential debate, how many times did the Republican candidates mention Republican President George W. Bush's name? And congratulations to Neil Reinen in Salem, Oregon. He knew that the correct answer was zero. So good on you, Neil. Congratulations. You had done good, indeed. And Neil wins a copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And we're going to toss in a copy of my most recent book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. So, Neil, you got a twofer there. Christy Harvey on the line with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications. What a cool title. At the Center for American Progress, also does the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org, AmericanProgress.org. Of course, the website for the Center for American Progress. Hey, Christy.
I know. I love that word strategic dropped in there.
Isn't that cool?
The Wonder Woman. Exactly.
Yeah.
Love
it's like,
it.
Yeah, I expect to see you in, you know, the tights and the cape. You know, it's like, ah, this is strategic woman.
Definitely a lasso of truth. That's
yeah,
what I want.
There you go. Well, I quoted you yesterday. I don't recall to whom, but, you know, somebody mentioned Henry Waxman. And I said, oh, yeah, he's the guy that Christy Harvey calls the mustache of justice.
Mustache of justice. Yes, love him.
In any case, looking at the news of the day, there's some strange stuff and some big stuff. The strange stuff to start out with, soldiers' mail. This seems
one,
like, you know, it shouldn't be an issue, right?
It really, this one I just thought was really sad. And it turns out, you know how it's sort of a holiday tradition, especially during war times, church groups, and I know we did it when I was in the Girl Scouts and things like that. You write to soldiers who are overseas or who are wounded or something like that. And so, you know, 500,000 letters come in usually for just addressed to an American soldier, dear wounded soldier, or such a something like that. And we found out this week that the Uncle Sam has been throwing those letters away for the past few years.
You're kidding.
They decided.
I assume it's not actually Uncle Sam.
Not actually Uncle Sam. It is actually the military.
It is this Pentagon.
This Pentagon.
Under presumably started under Mr. Rumsfeld.
Yes. And they decided that it was too risky because some people could either send things about how they didn't support the war or would send anthrax to soldiers. So last year they threw away 450,000 pieces of mail for soldiers at Walter Reed because they were only addressed to Dear Wounded Soldier.
You're kidding.
This year they're doing the same.
You're kidding.
And they said it's too expensive and takes too much time to go through each and every piece of mail to make sure that it doesn't say something mean or that it doesn't have anthrax. Because you know how often, you know, people are sending anthrax these days.
Oh, yeah. It just happens all the time.
All the time.
And everybody wants to send a mean note to the soldiers. And our soldiers, of course, are not adults and couldn't deal with it if they got a mean note. It would just, you know. I mean,
well, that's the thing. You trust them to go over and be able to handle, you know, fighting a war and coming back and fighting the bureaucracy to get their health care and all this stuff, but you don't trust them to be able to handle a note that they could just throw away?
To get a Christmas card, yeah. I mean, it's nuts. And these are the cons who always complain about the nanny state.
Right.
This is the ultimate. We're going to protect you from, you know, from nothing, apparently. Anyhow, the energy bill. Is moving its way through Congress, and limping might be a better.
I'm depressed. depressed about it, Tom. I really am. I don't know if I'm too idealistic these days or what, because, you know, I see all this stuff happen in Congress, and I see the Democrats unable to push through really good bills, and I see the Republicans who are in the minority still being able to have control that they shouldn't have, and it just gets depressing, and I really thought that it was not going to happen with this energy bill. This was a good bill.
Yeah.
And the Republicans were fighting because they were mad that the bill would take back $13 billion, that's with a B, $13 billion worth of free tax money that is just being given, handed out willy-nilly to the five biggest oil companies.
No, we can't have that. We can't have that. You know, in a previous segment, I made the comment, Harry Reid, you know, you're a Marine, stand up like one. I was under a misapprehension. Apparently, Harry is not a Marine.
Okay.
May not even be a veteran. I'm not sure where I got that from, but, you know, my original misapprehension. But, okay, is this Harry Reid being a wimp? I mean, it was 3 years ago, as I recall, this week, that the Republicans were standing up saying, we're going to blow up the filibuster. We're going to pull the trigger on the nuclear option. If you guys dare to filibuster the appointment of, what was it, Sam Alito?
Exactly. And I saw there was a piece in the Washington Post yesterday about how the Republicans' stated objective for the rest of this term is to block, filibuster, and deny, and to basically grind to a halt every single bill that they can so that nothing passes. And it's gotten to the point where there was even a switch made to put through a bill that they liked, and they automatically started to block it, and they went, oh, wait, sorry, knee-jerk there. Yeah, we'll let that one through. And all I could think of was, where was everyone a couple of years ago? You know, why is no one remembering how much they blew that up when the Democrats were trying to use their right to filibuster a bad judicial nomination? And, oh, God, the world exploded.
Yeah, you know, Charlie Rangel today said that the Democrats have Stockholm Syndrome. And I'm inclined to agree with him. They're identifying with their captors, and or battered wife syndrome or something.
I don't know
it's absolutely tragic.
It's depressing. I feel sick to my stomach about
it. And this is one of the reasons that I, on this program, am constantly encouraging my listeners to do something somewhat different than what most Democrats and progressives do when they call Congress. And I know, because I'm on the receiving end of this, and I also have, you know, I was going to say I have friends, I have acquaintances, one friend, Bernie Sanders, but a number of acquaintances who are politicians, and the calls that they get from people are like, you know, people calling Pelosi's office, for example, are going, damn it, you won't stand up for impeachment, I'll never vote for you. In fact, I'm going to work against you in the primary. I'm going to send a mail, I'll check the city she in, and we're going to take you down. And I'm, what I'm saying
to
people.
You do that very well, by the way.
Yeah. I've heard it enough, I'm telling you. And what I'm saying to people is, it's fine to call up and say, you know, I really disagree with your vote on that legislation. I really think that you ought to put impeachment back on the table. But the message that the Democrats need to hear right now is not the we're here to kick you message. It's the we're here to support you message. We need to be calling these people and saying, you know, we've got your back. Nancy Pelosi, if you will step out and take a courageous stand in favor of impeaching George W. Bush, or at least holding him responsible for these crimes, or Harry Reid, if you will take a strong and courageous stance with regard to this energy bill and take on the oil companies, I will be wherever you want me to be whenever you want me to be there. You want me on the corner here in Portland, Oregon, holding a sign that says Harry Reid's a good man, support him, or, you know, take down the oil company, I will do it. You want me sending faxes, I will do it. You want me sending emails, I will do it. I've got your back. Don't be afraid anymore. We, the American people, are here with you. And frankly, I don't think that these guys, these men and women in Congress, are hearing that. I would guess that that's 1% of the message that they're hearing from progressives and from Democrats. 99% of it is, how could you? I don't believe it. You're an idiot. You know, that kind of stuff. And we really need to change the way that we're messaging ourselves to our elected representatives.
I think that's a great point. And especially with this, I think the reason that this energy bill really sticks it to me so much is, you know, some of the other bills you can maybe not see what the other side is thinking, but this one should have been a no-brainer. You know, Exxon announced last year that they'd made more money that year than at any other company had ever made in the history of the world. They honestly did. They made more money than any company had ever made.
All the way back to the Roman Empire.
All the way back to the Roman Empire. And so it just seems like a no-brainer that, you know, maybe they don't need $13 billion worth of our tax money, and instead we could use that money to what this bill wanted to do, put it towards the development of renewable energy and conservation and good stuff. So if we can't even get that through, I thought, my golly, what is going on over there?
Yeah. Well, what's going on is that there is Stockholm syndrome, battered wife syndrome, is that not enough of us are calling in a supportive way. And you know, I have no problem with calling up and saying, shouldn't have done that. But we need to have a positive message. Motivation, effective motivation strategies contain both moving away from pain and moving toward pleasure. We need to offer the moving toward pleasure part. We need to offer the encouragement part to our elected officials.
I like it.
I understand that Gonzalez is on the cover of the American Bar Association or something. What's the deal here?
He is. He's on the cover of a magazine published by the American Bar Association as Lawyer of the Year.
This is like the American Dog Breeders Association putting Michael Vick on their cover.
Exactly. It really is. And they do explain inside. It's not because they think he's the best lawyer or even a good lawyer. They actually put it for his creating so much controversy and for really being the one lawyer that everybody was talking about this year. So I
now,
thought that
is,
was...
Now, I heard something about this earlier on the news, and I didn't know if it was a verbatim quote from the op-ed, you know, or the editorial saying, here's why we put him on the cover, or whether it was some sort of weird speculation. It almost seemed apocryphal that they actually cited Time magazine putting Hitler and Stalin on their covers in reference to Gonzalez on their cover.
Oh, golly, I had not seen that, but who knows? Wouldn't surprise me. But
yeah.
It's that same sort of thing that people always talk about, how it doesn't mean you're the best if you're the person of the year, just the person who got talked about a lot.
Yeah, yeah, tragically. I would suggest to the California or to the American Bar Association, you ought to think about putting the best person on the cover.
It'd be nice.
Yeah, let's, again, back to let's congratulate people when they do well. California on emissions. We have a little less than a minute here, Christy.
Quick good news then. A federal judge yesterday upheld a California law letting them regulate greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks, and it actually batted down the auto industry trying to take California on, saying they were not allowed to battle emissions. So that was a victory. That was some good news I thought I'd leave you with today, Tom.
Wow. That is good news. And other states presumably can benefit from this as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we have pretty strong standards here in Oregon, and Washington State does. In fact, it was kind of a three-state coalition that put some of these things together. Very good. Christy Harvey, the world-famous director of strategic communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks so much, Christy.
Thank you.
Great having you with us. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So now we're a nation at permanent war. I can't help but wonder just what it's all for. Are we killing for freedom? Or is freedom what's died? You should know the answer if God's on our side. You should know the answer if God's on our side.
The Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right in these United States, not a privilege. Ellen Ryder with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Ellen, what's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
I guess the most interesting news is the 12-7 decision in a committee to have a contempt charge for Chief of Staff Bolton and Karl Rove. Actually, both Arlen Specter and Grassley voted with the Democrats. Arlen Specter, Senator Specter, said he knows it's meaningless, but we have no alternatives, and this is into the fighting of the U.S. attorneys.
Right. Now, Specter says it's meaningless. Why would he say that?
It's meaningless because what's going to happen is even if they could get a full vote of the Senate, even if several Republicans vote with the Democrats and they could get that, you know, that 61 or whatever it would be for contempt,
right,
then the next point is that it would most likely the Bush people would fight it in court and then they would be out of office.
So the Bushies are going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court, and John Roberts will make sure that it doesn't come up for another year.
either that or just even on a district court, by the time it goes through the, you know, the district, the appellate, whatever, it's not going to happen within the next year. It's just nobody thinks that it could be on that kind of schedule. And, of course, you're right. Once it got to the Supremes definitely could dawdle.
Yeah. So this, so for example, the crime of Don Seligman or Siegelman, the Democratic governor of Alabama, being thrown into prison and after a show trial for appointing a campaign donor to a voluntary advisory board and calling that corruption, because he was yelling that the election got stolen from him. He went to bed believing that he'd been elected governor, and when he woke up in the morning, some votes had flipped during the middle of the night, and the Republican took
over. Siegelman's story is the biggest miscarriage. Well, I won't say the biggest. There's a lot of miscarriage of justices, but that's a big one.
Yeah. In fact, Dan Abrams is going to deal with it tonight on MSNBC. It's, what do you call it, must-see TV, record TV, appointment TV, I think is the phrase that Victoria
speaking of must-see TV, just in case I forget to tell you, tomorrow, Lead on 60 Minutes. This weekend is going to be the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, featuring our very own Charlene Espinoza as one of the people that Leslie Stahl interviewed.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's wonderful.
I'll remind you again tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Please do, by all means.
What else is going on? Quite a few other things. One is that the SHIP bill, as you know, the president vetoed it.
You're talking about the state children's SHIP.
Nancy Pelosi vetoed it. The president vetoed it. Nancy Pelosi today at her press conference said that they will do a short-term extension, and then on January 23rd, they are going to try and do a vote override on it.
Good. Good. So it is critical between now and January 3rd, and we had a member of Congress on earlier talking about this, it is critical to be calling Congress right now. Call your member of the House of Representatives, particularly if it's a Republican, oddly enough, because that's what they need. They need to flip, I think, 13 Republican votes. Call your member of Congress. The toll-free numbers for Congress are over at callcongress.org on the Internet, and which actually just goes to a page on my website, but we're compiling the toll-free numbers there, callcongress.org, and get the phone number. And if you're not sure who your member of Congress is, who your congressman or congresswoman is in the House of Representatives, just give the operator your zip code, because that individual phone number goes to the switchboard, and ask for your member of Congress and tell them politely, please vote to override Bush's veto of the S-CHIP program, the State Children's Health Insurance Program. This is important. Children's lives are at stake here. Literally, children's lives are at stake. Please vote to override Bush's veto. Very much so.
A couple other quick things. One, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, along with Charles Kernighan, have come up with a study that shows that most of Walmart's Christmas decorations are made under essentially slave labor conditions in China, with kids under 16 working, with people being docked 2.5 days if they try and take Sundays off.
Children under 12, actually, was what I heard. Children under 12 working from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. or 11 p.m. or something like that. Like 16-hour days, 7 days a week. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Mind-boggling. And actually, the report, which is really quite an amazing report, and you can get the report at www.nlcnet.org. And it's called A Walmart Christmas, brought to you by a sweatshop in China. And it's got all the documentation in it. It really is quite an amazing report, and good for Senator Dorgan on that front. And also the NOAA, which is the
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Exactly. Said that 2007 is probably going to be the warmest on record since they've been keeping data since 1895.
Yeah, well, 9 out of the 10 most warmest years in the history of the world have been in the last 10 years. I mean, it's a trend that's continuing. And now they're talking about, you know, the ice within 5 years to 6 years. Al Gore was talking about this today in Bali. Could completely vanish from the Arctic. I mean,
World Resources Institute is saying that Democrats and their fuel efficiency is not going to make a difference because of the increase in population as well.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great having you on. By the way, just a reminder, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, University of Minnesota Bookstore, Kauffman Memorial Union. Be there, be square. I'll be there. And coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, and Anything Goes Friday. I'll be broadcasting live from Air America, Minnesota. So just show up. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.